Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to this very special edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. We're filming here live in Singapore at Podster Studios, and to chat about some really interesting stories today, I'm joined by Lindsay Rantree. Lindsay, ExchangeWire COO, welcome.
Lovely to be here. Lovely to be with you, and obviously in Singapore.
I know, we're on location.
This we is are, wonderful. Great.
And we are joined by Charlotte McElhinney, our APAC and MENA correspondent, who is we're lucky enough to have in the flesh here. Charlotte, thanks so much.
Welcome to Singapore.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming all this way.
Yeah, a long way to come for a podcast, I must say. You know. Yeah,
we did it for you. We've arrived here. But no, we are thrilled to have you. It's your debut on the ExchangeWire podcast.
I'm excited.
Yeah, great.
And we have three really juicy stories to get into today, actually. We are looking at a landmark corruption case in China's ad industry, Amazon facing a major unfair contracts lawsuit in Australia, and Shopee and Meta's latest push into social commerce. Going to start us off with corruption today.
Just a very chill.
Yeah, very light.
Light and light. Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Defei, the former chief investment officer at Group M's China operations, has been sentenced to life in prison over a bribery scheme in which he and colleagues allegedly received 1.2 billion yuan, that is $1.76 million, in kickbacks between 2019 and 2023. Life imprisonment for an ad industry crime. This is serious. This is big scale stuff. I'll start with you, Charlotte. What does a case of this scale suggest about the structure of the ad industry, the incentives, the kickbacks, and, you know, budgets in general?
I think what's interesting, I mean, number one, this is individuals pocketing that. So I think that's the one of the distinctions that I think everyone kind of looks at and goes, well, that's not, you know, that's not an industry problem. They're kind of bad actors. The second part of this is like, oh, it's China. And I think in Asia, we often have this thing where it's like certain markets that kind of fall out of a global norm. You can kind of go, oh, well, that's China, or that's, you know, whatever it is. So I think sometimes we have a tendency to do that. But I think in this case, I think that's a cop-out if we're doing that, because I think the structures that are in place, or at least the opacity around the structures that are in place, allowed a huge amount of money to go into someone's pocket. This is crazy amounts of money, and three people going to jail. Anyone that's been looking at this is kind of shocked by it at the scale. The sentencing as well, to your point, like we've not seen criminal actions, I think, against this kind of thing before. So it's a big discussion in APAC. The last couple of weeks, it's been the main thing that everybody's been talking about. But the repercussions of it from an industry level, I don't think we've seen much discussion around at all. I don't know what you guys are seeing. Have you seen much conversation about this in Europe?
No, frankly.
No.
You know, we met earlier in the week and you sent the story over to me and I was floored by the amount of money that was involved and the fact that no, there wasn't in industry conversations back at home at Cannes. There's not many people chatting about this. Lindsay, have you heard much from the UK end?
No. So obviously when their offices were first raided back in 2023, that did make the global industry news, and that was talked about because it was a big holdco is being raided. That's mega, like what's happening. But now that it's like, oh, it's fine. Like it was embezzlement, it was fraud, it was they're claiming it to be bribery, and the person and like Defei is saying it wasn't bribery. Like I didn't bribe the clients out of money. I took it from WPP, and they kind of, you know, it's their money really, and they managed to get it back anyway. So kind of what's the real issue? But I think that the second that it became, oh, it was one bad actor or three bad actors, then it just became less relevant. But also, there's a lot of conversation. Like we were talking before the podcast started. Like, you know, if I look at this from a sort of European lens, the fact that you said that, you know, that you asked the question of has it been mentioned in Cannes. I mean, I wasn't in Cannes, but you were. You said it hadn't come up anywhere. I haven't seen it come up anywhere in European or US news. And I think that there's a good reason for that. And well, there's a few things to unpick here, right? The good reason for that is because there's other, conversations around nefarious mm-hmm. activities when it comes to agency activity. You know, one that comes up quite a lot, which is a completely legal practice, but people don't like it, is principal media buying. Mm-hmm. And so whether you agree or disagree with principal media buying, the premise of it obviously is that it allows an agency to be able to be more efficient, to monetize better in a world where margins are being constantly squeezed. So that is their argument for needing to do it. And also it helps give them more buying power. And that is essentially the soil within which this has grown, because there's a similar-ish practice in China, if I understand correctly, yeah. in that you would send all of your media to effectively a broker mm-hmm. and they would, so all the media from all the money from all your clients goes to a broker, and they would then use their own heft and power to buy. And it was because of those practices that kind of sit outside of the auditing process that this was even allowed to happen in the first place. 100%. So I think that from a European perspective, this needs to be looked at from a sense of it wouldn't take much for that to be the next stage that happens. It's not just like it's about a couple of bad actors. They existed in an environment where it was even able to happen in the first place.
Yeah.
And that's what I think needs to be looked at, surely, because that's where the concern lies. And, you know, you've got, you know, for example, there's a civil case, but it's along the same lines of Richard Foster is suing a former WPP exec in the US is suing WPP over what he thinks is, I think, $4 billion of basically embezzlement of client funds. Yeah. And, you know, again, civil case, nothing been proven in court yet, but there's murmurings. And if you look at transparency conversations generally, they've been bubbling. You know, back in 2016, when the ANA released their explosive report in the US, mm-hmm. we were at ATS New York around the time it came out. And it was all a bit like, you know, all anyone can talk about in APAC at the moment is this news about WPP. It was all anybody could talk about in the US at the time. And then 2020, you know, around the time COVID hit, PwC and ISBA launched their transparency report saying mm-hmm. that they had 15% of... they've got no idea where 15% of the fee of client budget goes, and we still have no idea where it goes. That then obviously kind of we did the report and said, oh, it's much closer to zero now. We, you know, we're all good, we're fine. But it's their headlines that get people. If a client, if a brand sees agency has done XYZ, straight away there'll be transparency questions, and there already are, because there's already questions around what, you know. I talked about squeeze margins. There's already questions around kind of what value an agency can bring to a brand nowadays. You know, in the world of AI, an agency needs to be able to prove its value, because they can't sell on time anymore. They've got to sell on value. There's a conversation I had with a few brands this week, you know, in the run up to ATS panels that I'm going to be moderating. And again, that ties in with this whole thing. So this one big thing about three bad actors, like, it's all sort of like growing from the same soil. And that, I think, is what makes it very, very interesting. And I ramble on there, but... I'm with you.
The soil that it's growing from is squeezed margins, right? And this is what I find interesting about the transparency conversation, because, again, this isn't the first time this has come up. It's not in APAC. We've had quite a few scandals over the years around transparency. I think it was like there was a big scandal with Dentsu overpricing, overcharging clients, a few things like that. That caused a huge kind of round of auditing of behavior, I think, like 10 years ago. And it's gone quiet for a little bit in APAC, I have to admit, this transparency argument, because people want a deal and they want cheaper prices, and they, you know, their CFO's on their back, procurement's on their back. And so it kind of goes quiet. So there is this tale of two stories here where clients are like, oh, I want transparency, I don't want this happening, but also I want rock bottom prices.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's an agency to do? I mean, they can make people redundant and then say that AI is going to solve their problems, which is also happening. So it's like these they're trying to find solutions to a margin issue. And the opacity is obviously kind of potentially helping in the middle ground there. But the soil that you're talking about is a squeezed margin. I think that's the root cause.
Yeah.
100%.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
Do you think the three bad actors that have been, you know, there's DeFay with life imprisonment, the other two have got 14 and a half years and then 4 years. So it's still being pinned on three bad characters here. Mm. Is that just papering over fundamental structural issues of holdcos? It's just one of the challenges that they're facing at the moment, I suppose.
I think because there is an important distinction here, because they've not given it to the agency to like boost minimal margins or whatever. They've literally put it in their own pockets. And I think, so potentially, you know, no one had a clue. I don't know. But certainly the fact that there is murkiness in the process has allowed them to get away with that for some time, I assume. Like, it is wild to me that you wouldn't know that you know, $100 and something million is missing out of your P&L.
You're not losing that in the sofa. That's that's a
crazy,
incredible amount of money that no one notices.
But that, I mean, and that, but that again points to the auditing process that again is always a bit of a bone of contention between the brand and the agency, and the fact that the this money, because the brand had given the agency the money, they'd given WPP the money, and then whatever happened to it afterwards was able to be kept out of the auditing process. So whatever the brand was looking for in their lines of, you know, in their finance sheets, they weren't able to see that because it was accounted for somewhere else. So it would come under a different line item, and they'd gone, okay, fine, that was used as normal. That was spent in a on my media, I'm assuming, and that's all fine. That again is the concern, because that is the thing that I think will raise concerns for brands globally, is the auditing process, because again, it just goes back to this transparency and opacity that exists. Well, does it exist? Is perceived to exist within the holdcos, and I don't want to tarnish every holdco with the same brush, but I think one of the reasons why it's not maybe being talked about much is because everyone's like, oh, I don't want to put my head above the parapet in case something comes out about something happening in my company. And that, you know, there's a lot that's not known about. The fact that these three people were able to get away with this and hide it for so long, and other people would probably have had no idea what was going on around them, and yet it still happened, does show you there's an issue somewhere. And that fundamental issue that has obviously existed in WPP, maybe not globally, but certainly in China, could easily exist anywhere else as well. And there's going to be a lot of people in the background kind of going, while it isn't being talked about publicly, it'll be talked about in boardrooms, it'll be talked about in agency boardrooms, kind of going, we need to make sure that we've got our checks and balances in place, especially because there are already question marks around principal media buying from some people. There are already question marks around transparency and opacity anyway. And with margins being squeezed and with people saying, well, AI can do this. If you can't sell me value, give me the optimization logs. Which again is what happened around the ANA report release, was give me log file data. And the agency will go, okay, sure, there's 10 million lines of of media buys on that. Do what you want with it. And they would have gone, actually, I don't know what to do with this. I'm just leave it back to you again. Well, now I can put it in Claude and I can do something, and Claude can tell me what it is, and Claude can say it in an unbiased way, exactly what the optimization log looks like. So the more that this sort of stuff happens, and the brand goes, do you know what? I can just do it myself. Do you know what? It's easier if I do it myself. Like, that's a dangerous place for us to potentially be in.
Or independents.
Absolutely.
The capacity to just be like, we're fully transparent. That's our model. Potentially this opens up a really interesting conversation for those guys. I mean, obviously they don't have the benefits of scale. But if you're a brand that sort of says, actually, I'm willing to pay a bit more for transparency, I actually care where this goes, then there is a space where independents can go, well, you know, we're not getting the best deals because we're not engaging in this, but we will give you X amount of control and, you know, X, Y, Z. So I think there's a really interesting potential here for the smaller independent media shops.
I think so as well. And I think that if you then overlay the AI conversation onto that, the independents are much more transparent around their use of AI, and they have a much clearer party line, because the holdcos are still trying to work out what their relationship with AI is and how they communicate what that looks like to the value they're giving their client. I think the independency, the boutique agencies, can probably do that much more comfortably and much more flexibly.
Yeah. They're turning around a smaller ship as well, right? Like, I think that's the challenge when you're a big beast and you're figuring out this AI play. It's like you're potentially arguing that X amount of people aren't needed, or, you know, whatever. It's not a narrative that's particularly comfortable. But in a smaller shop, you can say, actually, that bit's automated, that bit isn't, that's where we add value. And it's a little bit easier, I think, to find your narrative, as you say. I think maybe that's a benefit for plus side to take from this.
I was about to ask you about turning tankers and the power of independence and holdcos and the threats to them, but you've both preempted that. And we've done that, so, and that's exactly how I like it. This is why you're the guests and I'm the host. So I'll move us on from that. But I think like you said, Charlotte, this is a big huge story, and it's one I'm glad that we could cover, because it does have a lot of different wrinkles and ramifications for our whole ecosystem.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Good. Moving on. More courtroom drama, in fact. As Australia's competition regulator, the ACCC, is suing Amazon over unfair contract terms affecting more than 1 million annual Prime subscribers. They allege that Amazon has used 5 one-sided clauses to introduce ads into Prime Video without offering refunds, forcing subscribers to pay extra to keep an ad-free service that they'd already paid for. Crikey.
Crikey.
didn't even mean that in the context of us. That's just me. So Amazon is said to be knowingly concerned by this. We've seen a lot of streamers add tiers to it. We've had the different models, you know, Netflix kind of adding a tier you could opt into, Amazon requiring you to opt out and pay more to not have ads. Could this set a precedent in how ad tech and ads have been put into streaming services, Lindsay?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that it feels like this is another, there's elements of this that ring alongside the first story with transparency to a degree, but also the fact that what happens in an APAC country is that action takes place and then the rest of the world kind of go, oh, we should have done that. We should have done something about this. And I feel like Australia are very good at doing that. I think it's their second thing they've done with Amazon in the past couple of months. I'd forget what the first one was. But I think that what this looks like from a perspective of customer usage and advertising is that I think Amazon have already kind of changed their clauses already to sort of say, oh, there'll be sort of like fair, like there's now a fair use clause gone in. So even though they're claiming they don't believe in this, the fact they've already done that means it will set a precedent to the rest of the world. So any other countries that have similar kind of rulings to Australia, like UK and EU being one big region that will have that, I think that's going to probably happen across the board. But I don't know what it will really do from an advertising perspective, because I think that the ad-funded model that every streaming platform is now pretty much on board with, I don't think it... I understand the frustration from the consumer. Like, if I've just been dumped onto an ad-funded model without being asked to be, well, the alternative is you pay more money or you just leave the platform. Like, what else are you going to do? Either you have ads with this payment or you don't. Like, if you don't want, you don't like it, you can go. And while the fair use clauses are now being brought into place, I think that from an advertising perspective, it's not going to change that much. It's going to, I don't think that an advertiser will look at this and go, well, this is not a good place to be putting my budget or putting my money. And so from that perspective, I don't see much change. Will it change the way that the back end works? Again, probably not really. Like, everything seems to be still developing on that front, certainly across like the likes of Netflix and Prime, that's still quite new, kind of on the ad supported tier. And everyone's now pretty much ad supported. I think that what this could also raise questions about is, you know, for example, I'm not Singapore based, I'm in the UK. I travel to Singapore, I try and use Netflix, and I have an ad supported account on Netflix. I cannot watch Netflix in Singapore with my account. Mm-hmm. I have to upgrade to a paid to an ad-free subscription to be able to view Netflix in Singapore, which is really effing annoying, by the way. but here we are. And have I upgraded? No. Out of principle, no. I will just not watch Netflix stuff while I'm here. That's fine. But I'm not angry about it or bitter about it in the slightest. But there's things like that that...
Just got to get a VPN, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, and then there is that, and then just pay for a VPN. But there are things like that it will make people look at T's and C's more about, okay, what am I really getting for this ad-funded tier? Yeah, sure, I'll watch a few ads for like much less money. Oh, actually, what does it actually mean? And did I really read the T's and C's? And do I know what I'm getting into? I think that's where it will raise more questions.
Yeah, I interpreted it as the Australian government on a bit of a like naughty Amazon, because the way they've behaved and the way they've done it, it was a bit like, and they're kind of on a run of that. So ultimately, I think what they're saying with this case is people who had bought their subscription for the year should have been allowed to see that out.
Carry on for the rest of the year. Yes.
Until the renewal came up. Whereas Amazon went, middle of your contract, and made it very difficult for them to cancel. Because again, I think as long as you then allow people to not only cancel, but get a refund pro rata for the rest of the year, the Australian government is saying that would have been okay.
Yeah.
So I think there's a sort of UX in applying ads that I think is kind of being developed here. But I don't think it's going to put off advertisers. But for me, it was interesting because the Australian government are on a bit of a roll of taking down these tech companies a peg.
Mm.
And because you've got the social media, kids' social media ban, the privacy regulation that's come in around children, the gambling ad regulation that's just come in, and it's starting to kind of place pressure on the tech companies in a way that they haven't really had to before. Almost like in some places, recategorizing them into spaces that I think we've want to see them in. Like publishers are held to a certain standard, right? You have to, brand safety, you know, you have to make sure that the context of things is appropriate. They, you know, if you think about Google and search results, they're not deemed as a publisher, so they're treated very differently. So I think some of the, in this case of the streaming ads, that's not where it's happening. In the gambling ads, in the children's regulation that's happening, you're starting to see these regulations kind of putting these tech companies back into a place where they're a little bit more, fairly judged against legacy businesses, I think, in the regulation that companies been around for a long time have had. So I think that's quite interesting. Australia seems slightly ahead than other markets with getting its act together and kind of understanding potentially how to regulate some of this stuff. And to your point, the Europe and the UK do have guardrails where they could potentially adopt some of this. So I think they're all watching each other. There's a few markets I feel like are kind of looking at the governments and what each of them are doing and going, how do we kind of apply this? And it's been tough for them for a while. It's I mean, we all find it hard to keep up with these companies and what they're up to. And let alone governments that, you know, how do you retrain all of these people to really understand all of this stuff? But Australia, give them credit. I think they're starting to unpick some of this. So that's what I thought was kind of interesting in this. It feels like a piece of a bigger regulatory puzzle for me.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think that what's interesting is that Australia are kind of unpicking it, as you say, sort of piece by piece, and they're going after them in sort of what on the outside looks to be quite small scale stuff, but they're kind of coming at them with a lot of stuff at once.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that France have always been very good at doing as well. Sunil, isn't it? Kunal, very good at kind of going, right, we're going to get you here for this. Few million here, a few million euros there, a few million euros there. And they kind of go, oh, whatever, we'll just pay it all. And because it's so small, they don't fight it. But if you keep doing it enough, it's enough to actually make sort of small but meaningful change. Whereas in the US, for example, it has to be the big gun and try and bring them all down in one go. And that so far isn't being that successful. What Australia are doing does seem to actually be working. And you're right, like holding them to the same standards as other legacy businesses. And publishers often are more local. They're not often US-based massive tech companies. I mean, don't get me wrong, some of the publishers are owned by global companies, but they're able to be held to the same standards more easily. And it makes sense that Australia are kind of leading, it's great they're leading the charge in trying to do that. And, you know, for example, a social media ban is something that other markets are looking at, including the UK. And they're looking very closely at what Australia are going to do with it and how it's going to play out in practice. And there's a lot to be learnt from the way that Australia are tackling this. Because I like it in the sense of it seems to be small but mighty.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I don't know what the ingredient is. This is probably something we should kind of look into. Like, what is it about Australia? I think there is a protectionism like culture, a little bit. You know, I think the local media is quite relatively healthy there and things like that. So I think, and you actually see lots of very successful scaled local brands in Australia. So that there is an ingredient there that kind of encourages, I think, local brands to succeed. So I think that's part of it. Like I was looking into the gambling ad regulations that are coming in are super interesting, because if you dig into that, it's another thing I think I'm hopefully write something about. It's super interesting when you get into it. But it's starting to be quite savvy in terms of people are going to have to prove that within the plumbing of ad tech and the way that ads are delivered, that they are gating things and restricting things. So it's not only just on this sort of surface level of, you know, has X person seen this or not? There's a lot of quite technical elements of the regulation that I think means that a Google or a Meta, whoever this is behind this, are on the line as well. Again, back to that point of it's not just publishers who already have regulation against, like, oh, we can't show this at a certain point because it's after X amount of time. It's much more complicated than that. It's really interesting. I don't think that nuance is quite being kind of shown in regulation elsewhere. I could be wrong. But fascinating. Australia's a case study on kind of regulating against tech companies is yeah, fascinating.
No, it is. I think you make a really good point, because actually, if you look at, you know, there's a bit of a crackdown happening with gambling ads in the UK as well. And there's obviously the ongoing HFSS, which is high fat, salt, sugar advertising from brands. Obviously, there's watershed laws in our country, but it's very, very complicated that, you know, if I'm on my Skybox in the UK and I'm watching a certain piece of content, I have to put my pin in after a certain time. But if I'm watching it on Netflix, I haven't got to do that. And, you know, if I was watching, say, Stranger Things and they show a can of Coke, there was the ongoing joke in Stranger Things about the fact that, oh, they tasted it. It's like, oh, no, they changed the flavour, because back then they didn't, that did in the 80s. Well, under laws in the UK, if that were on the BBC, they wouldn't be able to show it, because it's technically a product placement of a high fat, salt, sugar item. But if it's on Netflix, they can, because and there's going to be a lot of rules around that. And it's complicated to unpick that and try and work out, well, the legacy watershed and HFSS rules in the country that apply to our kind of endemic broadcasters is easy to implement, because they've already had to work, is building on rules that already exist. But when you're a streaming platform and the rules you set the rules yourself, basically, which is what you're doing, then it's much, much harder to implement it. And actually, it takes a lot more unpicking. And Australia seem to be getting good at doing that.
Yeah, or they're at least pushing that question on to tech companies, right?
Yes.
It's like, how can you prove that a child hasn't seen this? How within the technology can you prove that? Because, you know, X, Y, Z. So, I it's interesting that the regulation pushes questions that onto people who haven't had to really answer that before, I think. And I think that's what will be interesting to watch, is the response to some of this. And one of the interesting things is, like, as global advertisers, so, you know, if you're in Singapore and you're doing the media buying and you happen to be buying ads in Australia, you need to understand this stuff. Like, it's not just like Australian ads bought, you know. If you don't do this properly, you will get fined. So I think it does have ramifications outside of just it being interesting and, you know, the regulations that's happening. There will be ramifications for people who buy media in Australia that do not follow these rules. So, I think this is going to be slightly bigger than it's kind of bubbling up to be. I think it started off as a very local Australia story, but I see some of this stuff getting bigger.
Interesting. And I wonder if it's who's asking the questions in Australia. Mm. Like, I don't know sort of like how it works, like how these inquiries start. But, you know, in the US, like the Senate, they're all about 102 years old. In the UK, it's often led by the House of Lords. They're all about 102 years old as well. If they are younger, more tech savvy in Australia, which the government sort of generally seems to be anyway, you wonder if that's how things are able to get going more quickly, because there's just more savvy questions being asked.
Well, I did a story on the children's privacy regulation that's kind of bubbling under at the moment. So by the end of the year, a policy will be kind of in around regulating against sort of data protection around children and not taking children's data and things like that. And that's actually one of the interesting pieces of regulation that pushes the question kind of down the pipes almost.
Why?
Like, how do you know you're not taking children's data? Like, do you know a child is watching this or not? How do you verify that? Things like that. What was I saying? What was your question? This is quite a class. I've totally lost my train of thought.
Well, I was talking about everyone being 102 in the government.
Yeah. Tech-savvy regulators.
Yeah. Tech-savvy.
Yeah.
It went to an inquiry that invited the public, the business, there was a big opportunity for everyone to kind of input into this, and they did open roundtables, things like this. So it was very much from government, but they opened it up to a lot of people.
Interesting.
So I think it was like a bit more collaborative. Excuse my brain, not feeling collaborative today. But yeah, I think that's the interesting thing. They seem to be working a lot more with the industry and kind
great.
Of negotiating. Exactly. That seems to be how to, I mean, not that the other governments are not involving industry, but it just seems to have been appreciated by the industry that they were so collaborative.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Remove the blockers that appear to be existing in other countries, including our own. Yeah.
Or if you don't understand the tech, find people
ask
who
someone
do.
Who does. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
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 Good. Yeah. Well, Australia leading the way in flat whites and big tech litigation. I love it. On that kind of segue, I'll move us on to our next story.
Is it a segue?
It's not remotely
no.
a segue. We're going to have to edit that out. couldn't be further away from a segue. Anyway, third story. Shopee and Meta have extended their Facebook affiliate program to Instagram, letting eligible creators across Southeast Asia, Taiwan and Brazil tag Shopee products in reels and feed posts and earn commissions on completed purchases. The companies are also piloting paid affiliate ads as Shopee builds out creator-led commerce to counter TikTok Shop's growth. Charlotte, I'll come to you on this one. How do you see the strategy working in terms of rivaling TikTok Shop? I know social commerce, creator commerce is a huge thing, particularly in this, you know, specifically in this region, really. So how do you see this one as playing out?
I don't know if I can predict the impact on kind of rivaling TikTok. I just think competition is a good thing. TikTok, I feel, has owned this space for quite a while. And it's just good to have choice. I use both apps, and so I, you know, and actually I'm a millennial, so I use my Instagram more than my TikTok. So actually, and I use Shopee. So it's like, as a user experience, I think adding a little less friction on that is quite interesting. So I think they're just playing catch up from my perspective at the moment. But yeah, offering more choice, improving the user experience can only be a good thing. And there's plenty of creators that aren't on TikTok, right? This sort of opens up a slightly different audience of creators. And I think it's exciting. I mean, it's such a huge phenomenon in Southeast Asia that everyone is so native to using their social media platforms to shop, to play games, to do everything. I mean, this isn't even thinking about kind of super apps and spending your life on some of these apps. This is in a purely social sense. It feels like a natural progression. And interesting that kind of Meta is taking the route of partnering versus trying to kind of own that itself. I think that feels sensible to me because, you know, Shopee has its own kind of audience as well. I think potentially there's a mutual sort of playback on here. It's cool.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, it is. It's a really interesting one. You're saying about, you know, the different platforms. ATS Singapore is this week, of course, which is why we are over here live in Singapore. I'm doing a panel on creators, and had a briefing with one of my panelists who is a creator, and he was telling me all about the kind of the differences between the platforms, where they see the audience, what content works on each. And it's funny because I wouldn't think of YouTube Shorts or Reels or TikTok as having like a unique audience. I think, you know, they are one and the same kind of style. And it's like, no, they have different things across different places. And it'll be interesting to see how the success of TikTok kind of feeds over into the Meta side of things. Lindsay?
So if each one's got a different audience, that means if you're a creator, you are creating different content for each different platform. Or are you putting the same thing across all three?
I think shaping the content for, yeah. They know what works where.
I find it fascinating because I'm not a massive social media. I'm an old millennial, and I don't use TikTok because I get addicted to it when I do. Yep. I do use Instagram, but I have bought things off Instagram and been scammed off things by Instagram. But I think that, I know, I was very annoyed. But I think that I think that what's interesting about this we talked last week about commerce media, and I'm moderating a retail media panel at ATS this week. And from the conversations I've had, you know, TikTok came up so much in conversation about, like, if I'm a brand, I'm TikTok is a huge channel for me, a huge area of growth for me. And it was basically TikTok and Amazon are the places. So TikTok is the way I can get to, if I'm a brand, I can put my stuff onto TikTok and I can help, and retailers will help sell it for me. And Amazon, same sort of thing. And then the retailers like Lazada, Shopee, Tokopedia, you know, they all came up as well. But this helps Shopee be able to compete more with, not compete more with TikTok, but sort of as well in a way, but compete more with Amazon, certainly, because it does also feel like Amazon is the easy place to put your money because you get so much from it. And so if you can get more data and kind of higher understanding and higher insights from putting your money into Shopee, knowing that it's going across social media and I can buy more easily from Shopee as a result, That's a really powerful thing in this region against the power and heft of Amazon, which isn't really commerce media. It's a whole other ecosystem, really. Yeah. But it's a whole other ecosystem that is kind of eating a lunch of everybody else. So this makes this very interesting. And, you know, as you both pointed out about the fact that there's different audiences across TikTok, across Instagram, across YouTube Shorts, etc. This again ties into potentially an older millennial, and there is a shoppy consumer that wouldn't typically buy on Instagram in that way, but seeing the kind of the trusted Shopee logo mm-hmm. means they might well do that. And that is, again, a really interesting perspective.
Yeah.
I don't think it will do much to TikTok, because TikTok feels like it has so much scale, especially mm-hmm. over here. And they are, and their TikTok shop is so well established. And what, and if you're an advertiser investing in TikTok shop, what you get is, you get really powerful insights, and TikTok are very, very clever at giving you insights that and giving you data that I think that more data than you might get from Amazon, because Amazon can be a bit secretive in terms of what they give you. And they'll say, well, it's worked, but in this cohort of stuff rather than kind of what works specifically. Mm. As I understand it, TikTok are slightly better at doing that and kind of a bit more open and transparent with advertisers. But again, if you're a creator, but it's great for creator because, again, like conversations I've had so far have been very like, everyone, all the brands investing in the retail space are really creator first, and they see social as being such a big part of their strategy. Mm-hmm. So if you're creator first and you've got an opportunity to work with a retail media network that you trust and that you know gets the scale you want, but also then work alongside that with creators that you trust and you know that your audience are trust creators, this feels like a really good partnership and a really good sort of marriage.
Yeah. I agree with you. On the consumer side, like, as a user as well, I think it does an interesting thing, because for a while, all of these different players have been trying to do the same thing, which is this like shop attainment, like crossover, let's monetize entertainment, let's also remove the friction from shopping. And the context of that happening on every single app you use is like so intense. It's like, well, I go to get a taxi, oh, there's a game.
Yes.
I go on to buy my groceries, there's live streams. Like, I go onto my social media, there's something to buy. And it's like, actually, I choose to use this. I choose to be here. And if they can connect together versus me having this kind of insane, like, I don't know, mix of different things, I think it's good. Yeah, I think it's good for consumers. And then at the same time, there's your point about advertisers, right? Like, you might have a preferred person to work with because the data's better and things like that. I think it does make it interesting. The other thing I think is interesting about this as well is this is going inside stories and some of these formats. I think TikTok really owns kind of live commerce and that kind of space.
So true.
Whereas Instagram, maybe because it's, you know, because the millennials
again. We're old. Yeah.
We like our stories and we don't want to be kind of wrapped into this kind of constant stream of stuff. You can dip in and dip out and then, maybe you can save it and come back to it later.
Yeah.
That's kind of a different user experience. That's a different way of shopping. So again, I think it just gives more choice. It'll be interesting to see how it develops, but I think the point about the creators is interesting. What are they getting? Because that might be an interesting competition point, because if they've got more choice then, and they'd start picking, oh, I want to work with TikTok because they pay me more, they, you know, X, Y, Z, I get more back off this affiliate deal. That will be quite interesting. So I haven't looked at the mechanics of how people get paid and how they choose, but that could dictate, you know, where this goes a little bit as well, especially if your big creators are kind of preferring different channels. So, we haven't had a lot of competition in this space. Actually, Shopee's and the likes of those guys have tried to do a lot of the live commerce stuff themselves to varying degrees of success. There's some good examples and case studies of where it's worked purely on the Shopee platform, but that will only get you so far, right? You have to, I think, connect to the social networks. It's a slightly different way of coming in. So, yeah, I think it will be exciting. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Really interesting. Yeah, I haven't been on TikTok for a while now, but it's they kept trying to sell me bin compressors, which was when I realised my age. And it was like when I started thinking...
bin compressors? Like one...
Oh, yeah, one of those levers you pull down and it pushes your bin down so you can fit more in the top.
I've seen that on Instagram and I've been very tempted.
It's like, wow.
I think I shared it with all my millennial friends and we all went, oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's a lovely bit of business.
That's
that
also just such an English thing as well, by the way.
Absolutely.
I mean, there is that. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yes. I'm a 41-year-old English person. They have discovered, me. They know me. Yeah. I'm seen. I want to, just before we go, Charlotte, I do want to dip a little bit into the creator economy over here. Mm. It is massive. And it's something, you know, it's picking up in Europe and the UK, but it has always been like APAC's always really been the leading light for it. Like, 100%. How do you see the ecosystem over here? How has it developed?
One of the interesting topics that I think might start going to other markets, that I think Southeast Asia particularly and China has a bit of a head start on, is the sort of micro drama part of this. I mean, I'm seeing stories of people in different markets getting kind of addicted to it, but it's more like, oh, have you watched this AI thing? It's kind of weird. Why am I addicted? There's like memes about this being kind of sort of strange content they're addicted to. Whereas here it's so mainstream. I went to a TikTok event recently, and the stats that they got, it was verified by Sensor Tower. So it wasn't their own data. They got some research commissioned. People are spending 40 minutes a day on microdramas. So their argument now is like, this isn't just like, you know, get on the bus, watch an episode and forget about it. People are sitting there and consuming it like they would their Netflix or, you know, Amazon Prime. So I think that's an interesting trend to kind of watch, because if you're looking at people's time per day, this seems like this frivolous, oh, what a funny thing to happen on social media, you know, coming from the West, like, isn't this sort of strange AI content? But it's like, actually in Southeast Asia, this is becoming quite a normal practice. But it's also breeding a new economy around that. You know, creating microdramas is much easier and cheaper to do than TV, obviously. So then, what I'm interested in is what comes out of this. Do new interesting creators kind of come out of this space, and what does AI do in this context, and how does that develop? And then that'll be interesting for brands. It lowers the barrier to entry for content, potentially for brands as well. I super interesting. And the scale, I think actually one of the other interesting stats from this report was, I think the global consumption of kind of microdramas, I think Southeast Asia is currently like 60% of global consumption. It's crazy. Southeast Asia is by far driving this. But I think that will change. I think South America, I think, is another market where they have telenovelas and are used to kind of this kind of drama content. Like a lot of this stems from people loving K-drama and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's kind of in that vein. So there are other markets that are kind of ripe for this. Be interesting to see if it becomes a phenomenon in Europe or the US, but it could be. But yeah, that's one of the trends that I think for sure is very APAC at the moment, and it will potentially move over.
It's just a terrifying indictment of attention spans, though, isn't it? Like, isn't it? I won't watch a 2.5-hour film, but I will binge 4 hours of one series or something. And then those same people that now would not watch a film but will binge a series are now going, well, I won't watch this little tiny video, but I will watch 40 minutes of these little micro dramas. It's like, well, this is what's the world coming to?
Yeah. We had this conversation the other day. I was just like, am I old or is this?
Yeah, exactly.
Again, yeah, very millennial of me, but I was like, what is this doing to our brains? I'm excited about the fact that young creators can get into a space and it democratizes that in some sense, but my fear is just like, what is happening to our attention span? I'm constantly in this space of like, this is so exciting. And then, oh my God, what is this doing to my brain? Yeah. That is just my fear now.
It's like, it's the instant gratification thing. And I think I think every generation for years could talk about that, about every different new form of media that comes along.
Yeah.
You're always getting closer to the source for gratification. But this is wild. Like a 1 minute micro drama that has a cliffhanger at the end of every episode. It's like, how much could your heart take if you were just up and down watching cliffhanger resolution?
We just watched England. I remember who we played.
Oh, Mexico.
Yeah. Wow. It was only a couple of hours ago.
Yeah.
And I almost had a heart attack during it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's micro dramas every few minutes.
I mean, I could have done with that being a micro drama, because my body was not up for that
worst
for an hour and a half.
2 hours of my life. But I think also what's fascinating about this, you're talking about the democratization of it. I think that's so interesting, because actually, if you look at the creator economy and now, like, a lot of the big TV broadcasters, you know, I would say throughout the world, are trying to kind of get in on the creator economy as well, and trying to get creators that are really well known, you know. I suppose Mr. Beast and KSI are two big examples from the UK and from the US that are they're trying to bring them into sort of TV environments. So Mr. Beast has got his own show on Amazon Prime, and KSI has got his own show with the Sidemen on Netflix. And they are going into a kind of traditional broadcast environment and going, that's not how, I'm not doing that. No, I will have all say and everything. Mm. I'm not going to let this go to 10 edits. I know what I'm doing. I've got full control over it. And also this, the way you guys work is so archaic. We're not doing that because it's going to take years and it's going to take probably $10 million to do it. I can do the same thing on my own and I could do it for about £1,000. And that democratization, I think, will make it interesting as to, like, things will start getting smaller and smaller and cheaper and cheaper because all these creators that can now come into this environment can do so on a budget with limited time, limited resource, limited money, and it will completely change the face of what traditional TV is going to look like. Mm. And you're already seeing creator-led content like on TV, on broadcast TV. You're going to soon start seeing micro dramas being broadcast on, like, I don't know, ITV or something, as like, you know, tune in at midnight and see like 10 hours of whatever. I was on holiday recently and there was a Samsung TV, and I've never watched Samsung TV channels, but a lot of that was like 5-minute dramas, not necessarily quite as extreme as the micro dramas you'll get on social media, but like a 5-minute drama here and there. And it's being monetized and advertisers can buy into it really cheaply, and someone somewhere is watching it. And it's just like the whole democratization of kind of what the millions and billions that have gone into traditional filmmaking, digital TV making, doesn't need to be a thing anymore. And that's going to cause problems for them, but it makes it fascinating to kind of see how that opens up for advertisers too.
Yeah, it does also come back to our earlier point of kind of ads-funded streaming as well, right? Because in Southeast Asia, this is one of the markets where you're only just seeing kind of Netflix launching a lot of their products into this market, but kind of feels essential because especially in kind of emerging markets. I mean, even in a market like Singapore or the UK, how many streaming services can you pay for before you're like, oh my God, this is £80? You know, no one has the spare cash to be subscribing. No one has spare cash to be doing that, let alone emerging markets where you don't have as much spare income.
Absolutely not.
So therefore you've got kind of ad-funded potentials and all of these things, but that's why they're watching social media. They're watching these things for free and getting entertainment. That's been a valid alternative to the ad-funded streaming platforms for quite a long time. Mm. So you're going to have to break into not only each other as a streaming platform, but people, the behavior to just watch content on social media is so baked in now.
Yep.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's going to be tough. And the model around a lot of the mini dramas is, you know, yeah, you're one minute cliffhanger. And then you get to kind of towards the end of the series, and some of them then drop a pay to watch the last episode. So it's similar to gaming,
lovely,
much more similar to the payment model of gaming than it is to a streaming platform, which I don't like. I don't like this kind of like tease, and then you have to pay now. But it's probably not a lot of money. So that's the other thing. It's like, am I going to pay a subscription, or am I going to every now and then drop whatever it is to kind of watch my favorite show? And, you know, I don't know how they work. Maybe eventually that price goes. It's interesting. But yeah, I think the model around how you pay for content is completely disrupted by microdramas as well. I think it'll be interesting to see what the streaming platforms do. Broadcasters they're more shielded from this, but certainly the streaming platforms.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to keep an eye on there, because that's, I mean, we talk about it like it'll, you know, spread in the future, but it could be 6 months down the line. We'll be talking about the growth of micro dramas and what it's done to the industry. Anyway, I'll leave us there. We've had a lot to cover this episode. Charlotte, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks
and
for having
joining
me.
Us.
Come back soon.
We will.
Yeah, definitely.
Certainly will. And Lindsay, thank you as always.
Thank you. It's been really good fun.
What a good day. Thank you all very much for watching and listening.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.